Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording of the reading and sermon from our Easter Sunday service, March 27th. Reverend Bodie's sermon is The Stumbling Stone of Easter. The musical selection at the end of the sermon is Dance on the Lawn by Carl Boehm, performed by Ikui Goldstein. Thanks for listening.
In my sermon this morning, I'll be talking about what I regard as the essential truth of Easter, and also about a stumbling stone that blocks us from that essential truth. The Orthodox Christian doctrine related to Easter is the doctrine of the physical resurrection of the body. That includes the specific resurrection of Jesus, as well as a general resurrection of all the dead at the end of time. And that was a belief that was already present at the time of the birth of Christianity. This doctrine is, of course, spoken of in the creeds of the Christian church, the familiar Apostles' Creed, for example, where it speaks of Jesus as crucified, dead, and buried. He descended into hell the third day. He arose again from the dead. He ascended into heaven. My readings this morning are some of the biblical stories from which the Christian doctrine of physical resurrection was formulated. And I begin with the traditional Easter story of the empty tomb and the disappearance of the body of the crucified Christ. This story that plays so predominantly in the Orthodox Christian tradition may actually not belong to the earliest strand of that tradition. The Apostle Paul, for example, whose letters are written prior to the Gospels, even though they appear after the Gospels in the New Testament scriptures, he does not appear to know about these elements of the story, or at any rate, he doesn't mention them in any of his accounts of the resurrection of Jesus. But I read from the Gospel according to Matthew, chapter 16, the first 8 verses. When the Sabbath was over, Mary of Magdala, Mary, the mother of James, and Salome brought spices with them to go and anoint him. And very early in the morning, on the first day of the week, they went to the tomb when the sun had risen. They had been saying one to another, "Who will roll away the stone for us from the entrance of the tomb?" But when they looked, they saw that the stone, which was very big, had already been rolled back. On entering the tomb, they saw a young man in a white robe seated on the right-hand side, and they were struck with amazement. But he said to them, "There is no need to be amazed. You are looking for Jesus of Nazareth, who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See, here is the place where they laid him. But you must go and tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you to Galilee. That is where you will see him, just as he told you." And the women came out and ran away from the tomb because they were frightened out of their wits, and they said nothing to anyone, for they were afraid. Now here is the Apostle Paul's listings of the appearances of Jesus after his crucifixion and death, and this is from his first letter to the church that he founded in the city of Corinth. He says, "For what I received, I passed on to you as of first importance, that Christ died for our sins according to the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day according to the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas," that's Peter, the disciple, "and then to the 12, Jesus' 12 disciples. After that, he appeared to more than 500 of the brothers and sisters at the same time, most of whom are still living, though some have fallen asleep. Then he appeared to James," that's Jesus' brother who became the head of the Jerusalem church, "and then to all of the apostles. And then finally he says, at last, he appeared to me also as to one abnormally born." And here's a description of Jesus' appearance to Paul. I would have you note that this meeting that Paul counts as meeting the resurrected Christ seems more to be a visionary account as we think of it, than a bodily encounter. Now, there's a number of different descriptions, and they vary in details, but this is the one from the book of Acts describing Paul's experience, that road to Damascus experience. And Paul, neared Damascus on his journey, suddenly a light from heaven flashed around him. He fell to the ground and heard a voice say to him, "Saul, Saul, why do you persecute me?" Saul was his name before the conversion experience. "Who are you, Lord?" Saul asked. "I am Jesus, whom you are persecuting," he replied. "Now get up and go into the city, and you will be told what you must do." The men traveling with Paul stood there speechless. They heard the sound, but did not see anyone. In some of the other accounts, they see the light, but hear nothing. At any rate, here it says, Saul got up from the ground, but when he opened his eyes, he could see nothing. So they led him by the hand into Damascus. For 3 days, he was blind and did not eat or drink anything. So that's the encounter that Paul had, that road to Damascus encounter where Jesus appears to him. And finally, I'm going to read a couple of verses from the Gospel of Matthew. These are not about Jesus' resurrection, but they give you a flavor of the worldview at that time with respect to this possibility of resurrection. And these are verses that speak of events that are related, that come after the death of Jesus. They're verses I don't recall anyone in theological school ever mentioning, because I think no one probably knows what to do with them. This is from the Gospel according to Matthew, the 27th chapter. So this is from the cross. Jesus, again crying out in a loud voice, yielded up his spirit. And suddenly, the veil of the sanctuary was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth quaked, the rocks were split. The tombs opened, and the bodies of many holy people rose from the dead. And these, after Jesus' resurrection, came out of the tombs, entered the holy city, and appeared to a number of people. It's Easter today, not a day like any other day, not a Sunday like other Sundays. It's Easter Sunday, and there's something more in the air, a heightened expectation. So let's talk about Easter and what we're looking for at Easter, its essential meaning and value, and how to get at that essential meaning and value. And I'd like to begin with a poem about Easter from author John Updike. He's one of the greatest American writers of the second half of the 20th century, a Pulitzer Prize winner more than once, a writer with a lifetime association with the New Yorker magazine, famous for a number of novels, particularly his Rabbit series, and an author that I've personally appreciated over the years. And for about 20 years now, I've been carrying an Updike poem on Easter with me, thinking that one of these Easters I'll tackle it, and this is that Easter. I must say I won't be able to get at it probably quite the depth I would like to, but if you want to follow along with me, you'll find it on the back sheet of the back page of the insert on the announcements. It's titled Seven Stances at Easter. seven stances at Easter. Make no mistake, if he rose at all, it was as his body. If the cell's dissolution did not reverse, the molecules reknit, the amino acids rekindle, the church will fall. It was not as the flowers, each soft spring recurrent. It was not as his spirit in the mouths and fuddled eyes of the 11 apostles. It was as his flesh, ours, the same hinged thumbs and toes, the same valved heart that pierced, died, withered, paused, and then regathered out of enduring might new strength to enclose. Let us not mock God with metaphor, analogy, sidestepping, transcendence, making of the event a parable, a sign painted in the faded credulity of earlier ages. Let us walk through the door. The stone is rolled back, not paper mache, not a stone in a story, but the vast rock of materiality that in the slow grinding of time will eclipse for each of us the wide light of day. And if we will have an angel at the tomb, make it a real angel, weighty with Max Planck's quanta, vivid with hair, opaque in the dawn light, robed in real linen spun on a definite loom. Let us not seek to make it less monstrous for our own convenience, our own sense of beauty, lest, awakened in one unthinkable hour, we are embarrassed by the miracle and crushed by remonstrance, that is, by evidence or proof. The doctrine of the literal physical resurrection of the body, taken at face value and in all its concreteness, must surely be one of the strangest ideas and doctrines ever conceived in the human mind or promulgated by religious organizations. Even to try to explain what the physical resurrection of the body could possibly mean is a problem, let alone to imagine how it could happen. Do the molecules of the bodies of all previously existing human generations somehow miraculously reconstitute themselves? Is one resurrected to a youthful physique, a middle-aged body, or an elderly one? Theologian Thomas Aquinas thought that 33 years of age was the optimal age for the resurrected body, and I can't say I disagree with him on that point. A host of other such questions could be raised, but it's almost embarrassing to try to make this doctrine concrete and literal or to try to apply any kind of rational thought to it. And yet, here's John Updike, this modern author and thinker, apparently arguing that if you're going to find real meaning at Easter, we should take the resurrection story of Jesus literally and not symbolically, not metaphorically, lest, as he says, in one unthinkable hour, we are the ones embarrassed by our arrogance. John Updike, who lived from 1932 to 2009, was a lifelong Protestant Christian. He was the grandson of a Presbyterian minister, raised Lutheran, joined a congregational church with his first wife, who was the daughter of a Unitarian minister. The congregational church, as Updike said, was a good midway point between our sects, S-E-C-T-S, like you have to, with Updike, you have to be clear about that. That is to say, a midpoint between the Lutheran and the Unitarian denominations. Since 1977, when Updike married a second time until his death in 2009. He attended the Episcopal Church, and according to Wikipedia, at the end of his life, Updike was working on a novel about St. Paul and early Christianity. This poem that I read, Seven Stanzas for Easter, was published in 1960. That would have made Updike 28 years old. And it was written at a time when he was struggling with the great questions of life's meaning and trying to find firm ground for himself, for his life. It was written at a time when he was furiously reading the work of the great Christian existentialist philosopher Soren Kierkegaard, who spoke of the leap of faith. And it seems to me that that is what Updike is doing. He's leaping toward faith in this poem that I read. There's another poem of John Updike's, and this one was published 30 years later in 1990. It's a poem also related to death. It would appear the death of someone close to him. And it's a poem without a hint of future resurrection, but rather one that speaks poignantly about the irreplaceable loss that occurs at death. Now, I don't know, perhaps in Updike's view, that irreplaceable loss would be filled at a future resurrection. I'm just not sure. But I want to read you this poem. I often read it at memorial services. It's a tender, sorrowful poem, and it's titled Perfection Wasted. And another regrettable thing about death is the ceasing of your own brand of magic, which took a whole life to develop and market. The quips, the witticisms, the slant adjusted to a few, those loved ones nearest the stage, their soft faces blanched in the footlight glow, their laughter close to tears, their tears confused with their diamond earrings, their warm pooled breath in and out with your heartbeat, their response and your performance twinned, the jokes over the phone, the memories packed in the rapid access file, the whole act. Who will do it again? That's it. No one. Imitators and descendants aren't the same. As I say, I don't know what the backstory of this poem is or who it was close to Updike who had died. Updike did not particularly like to talk about himself. He once quipped in an interview, "When the subject is myself, I want to jeer and weep." But in 2004, now at the age of 72, a few years before his death, 5 years before his death, in a talk on religion at St. Bartholomew's Episcopal Church in Manhattan, Updike told his audience, 300 people, that his Christian faith had solidified in ways less important to me than when I was 30, when the existential predicament was realer to me than now. I worked a lot of it through and arrived at a sort of safe harbor in my life. He said further that now he looked more to the congregation of his hometown Massachusetts church as the rock of his faith today, saying, "When I haven't been to church in a couple of Sundays, I begin to hunger for it and need to be there. It's not just the words, the sacraments. It's the company of other people who show up and pledge themselves to an invisible entity. So I don't know where John Updike ended up in his thinking about the doctrine of physical resurrection. I don't know how much in later life he would still look back at that early poem when he was 28 years old that argues that for Easter to be meaningful, you need to take the resurrection story of Jesus literally. Perhaps for him, by embracing something so, to my mind, wildly irrational, it helped loosen his ego grip on things and opened him up to world and to life and being in ways that he would not otherwise be open. Or perhaps he felt, as is indicated in that first stanza of that poem, that if that doctrine of the physical resurrection were given up, then the church would fall. A fellow writer at the New Yorker, Adam Kopnik, said of Updike, he was writing in the New Yorker, Updike's great subject was the American attempt to fill the gap left by faith, that is, by the loss of the historic Christian faith, to fill the gap left by faith with the materials produced by mass culture. He, Updike, documented how the death of a credible religious belief has been offset by sex and adultery and movies and sports and Toyotas and family love and family obligation. So I don't know exactly how Updike came out on these matters or how his theology changed, if it did. But like Updike, as a young adult, I also struggled with the literalism of these resurrection stories. And for me, I'll say that such literalism has not been an aid in experiencing Easter, nor do I think it's been particularly helpful for our culture. The literalism has been a stumbling stone to the deeper meaning of Easter. For me, the truth of Easter, the meaning of Easter, and the value of Easter ought not to hinge on whether or not you're able to bend your mind to take in such a literal belief set of physical resurrection. So what is Easter about? I remember as a youngster, before the stone of literalism got in the way of my enjoyment of Easter, I remember what it was about. It was about triumph. It was about the ongoingness of that which seemed to have been thwarted. As a youngster, still in what we say is the land of dreaming innocence, I wasn't at all bothered by the literalness of the story. All I felt was its triumph, first the sadness at the death of the beloved, the sense that all was lost, and then that surprise, that joy at finding that it wasn't so, that life went on. Is that same sense of triumph that I felt as a child still possible at Easter, even in the absence of such literal belief? It happens all the time in various areas. Movies, for example. Fantastic things happen in movies, and I'm carried along with them, and I'm not bothered at all by whether it's literal or not. And I'll give you an example, an extended example. Years ago in Grand Rapids, Michigan, I remember viewing a 1995 small-budget movie by a person who had Grand Rapids connections, written and directed by a Patricia Rosema. The movie was titled When Night is Falling. It's a story that begins with the main character's little fox terrier dog dying. And in her grief, the main character doesn't know what to do with her little dead dog, So she carries it into the house. She clears out a space in her refrigerator, and she puts the deceased dog in the refrigerator. Yes, I see you shaking your heads. It is strange. We know that the death of her dog means that something is going to happen, and that her grief at the death of the dog signals an opening of some kind of change that's going to be coming into her life. Her life's not going to be as it was. And so the movie goes on to show these changes. But meanwhile, the dead dog stays in the refrigerator. And in the back of our minds, we wonder when she's going to take the dog out of the refrigerator and either bury it or dispose of it in some way. At one point, a friend, this is in the movie, comes into the house, goes to the refrigerator apparently to get something to eat, and quickly shuts the door. So we continue to wonder, what about the dead dog in the refrigerator? It shouldn't be there. The movie director knows it's there in the refrigerator. This isn't an oversight. She has something up her sleeve. As we come near the end of the movie, the main character is distraught and wants to die herself. To this point, she's not been able to make the changes necessary in her life, and death calls to her. But finally, after much struggle, she makes a move. She goes to the refrigerator, she retrieves the dead dog from it, and because it's winter, she buries it in the snow outside and not in the ground itself. We puzzle. That's not a very deep burial. Ah, but she's crazy with grief. She's crazy with grief. But the dog is buried, and that signals that she has let the thing that needed to die, die. She had buried it. It signals the necessary change. And indeed, the movie story then goes on to complete itself with that main character changing. She's come through. She's been able to make the change that was called for, and indeed her life is renewed. The movie credits begin to roll. The camera pans to the burial place of the dog in the snow-covered field. The camera stops for a moment at that place. Then there's some movement in the snow. What is this? Some burrowing animal in the snow? Suddenly, out of the snow, the little dog emerges, shakes herself, and begins running exuberantly across the field. A cheer goes up from the movie audience. We are so pleased. At the literal level, of course, this kind of thing doesn't make any sense. Is the story asking us to believe that a dead dog can come back from life? Of course not. Should I let this thought spoil my sense of joy at the movie? Of course not. What is that joy? The knowledge and experience of the triumph of life. You feel it as a child. You feel it as an adult. You experience it in art. And most importantly, you experience it whenever your small life connects to larger ongoing life. Good Friday is a symbol of the surrender of your small life to the larger ongoing life. And Easter is the celebration of that larger ongoing life of which you are a small part, an ongoing life that we see springing up all around us at this time of the year. And this, to me, is what we're looking for at Easter, to acquaint and to reacquaint ourselves with that larger ongoing life that is able to take death in its stride and use it for further life, to celebrate and to experience that triumph of life that, that if we have eyes to see, is always here, now, forever. So to me, the miracle of Easter is not about some long ago, highly improbable nature, natural law shattering event, nor about some equally improbable natural law shattering future event. Rather, the miracle of Easter occurs whenever the crust of dead habit is broken through and our eyes are newly opened so that we behold yet once again the mystery and the power and the beauty and the connectedness and the ongoingness of that which is natural, which is infinite, which is yes. Amen. So may it be.